It is Friday, August 20th. I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang, here in the studio. With me are my co-hosts, Allison Cole and Carissa Thorpe.
Hello.
Hey. So Allison is running the controls today, and supervising the controls is John Pranger. Today on the show, we'll be interviewing Rita Mashinsky. She is a member of the planning committee from the Stop UBC Animal Research Campaign, which made its debut last week on the front page of the Vancouver Sun. Our featured interview is at around 12:35 with J.B. Mulcahy, the Director of Operations at the Chimp Sanctuary Northwest. The organization is home to 7 chimps rescued from a basement research lab just over 2 years ago. But before we move on, I think Allison has had another amazing dining experience which she would like to share with all of us.
So I had the opportunity to attend the Veg Meet at Vancouver dinner at the Wallflower Restaurant this week. First of all, I had only vaguely and randomly heard about the Wallflower about 3 whole times before in the past, and I'm not sure why this is, since it turned out that this place has been like a hidden gem for me. It is not a vegan restaurant, but happens to serve a pretty decent list of vegan items on its menu, which is always amazing for me to see at what I call a meat restaurant. And I think this is how it should be for a society of growing food needs and desires. They are certainly vegan friendly and even mention on their website that the veganized versions of some of their dairy dishes are for their vegan friends. I have to say that I think I have certainly just made a new friend in the Wallflower after this visit. Secondly, what intrigued me about this preset dinner was the really quasi-unique sounding menu that was being arranged for us. I say quasi-unique because the dinner items in their traditional form, that is pizza, chili, mac and cheese, are quite common North American foods to see, but are actually quite unique to find in a restaurant when you put a vegan spin on them. On the menu was a vegan chili, a dairy-free macaroni and cheese, pizza, a tofu peanut wrap, and an enticing looking dish called a hummus melt. This menu screamed comfort food to me, and I couldn't resist. I was looking forward to indulge in this evening of culinary fulfillment and what I hoped would satisfy the needy part of me that yearns for gooey and rich goodness of savory delights. Gooey, I say, because there were quite a few cheesy items on our menu, but these items were remarkably cruelty-free, as the restaurant makes ample use of the best melting vegan cheese to hit the market, Daya cheese, which is made of tapioca and not the common soy. You've probably heard us sing the praises of Daya on the show before, but I must do that more now after experiencing my first truly authentically cheese-like vegan macaroni and cheese ever. 5 days later, and I'm still thinking of that luscious creamy and silky mac and cheesy that was one of the highlights of the evening for me. I would go back to this restaurant just to get another taste of the Wallflower's mac and cheesy, but hopefully now I'll be even more motivated to replicate this taste and texture by using the Daya I already have in my freezer. Another huge plus for the Wallflower is that they do advertise that they use Daya cheese in their restaurant and will substitute the real cheese in any of their regular menu items with the Daya at no extra charge. Again, I think this is how it should be in every mainstream restaurant and is something I want to see burgeoning in the future of food service, to be able to serve a large stream of animal product-free customers with little effort. Not only should every restaurant, in my opinion, carry vegan Daya substitutes to sub out the dairy, but they should also be offering these substitutes at no extra charge, just like the Wallflower does. It should also be noted that the Wallflower will replace meat burger patties with vegan Boca burgers at no extra charge. So back to the food. I also want to highly praise the Nathan's Vegan Chili that we were served. So yummy and also so spicy. I love the fire and spice in this dish, but my only concern is that there are many people who would not. Now, the menu does not warn its customers that this chili is super spice induced, and knowing that there are many people there who can't really handle spice, it really should. That said, out of the vegan chilies that I have had at restaurants, and there have been some, this is probably the best one I've ever consumed. What can I say? I like fire and I like spice. I shall also briefly mention the gluten-free pizza we were served. First, you should know that the Wallflower usually only serves pizza on Tuesdays, but that aside, for a gluten-free vegan, this pizza would probably be a dream come true for you. Not being gluten-free myself, I still enjoyed the buckwheat crust as it was super thin, and to me that means less caloric and much less fattening than a typical puffy white flour crust. The restaurant also claims to have a gluten-free menu, which should interest those who abstain from this common ingredient. Finally, I will quickly send out my love for the tofu peanut wrap and hummus melt that we were served. The tofu peanut wrap and wrap enveloping a mixture of tofu, greens, carrots, peppers, and peanut sauce was extremely yummy, as was the hummus smelt. This hummus smelt was another huge favorite for me, as I've never seen anything like it before at a restaurant. But the distinctive combination of ingredients, that is hummus, spinach, grilled onions, mushrooms, and melted dea over a bed of baked focaccia bread, gave it the demeanor of a satisfying pizza with a unique flair. I keep saying over and over again that I will be returning to the Wallflower for more yumminess, as it can most succinctly be put, and I hope you check it out too. The Veg Meet at Vancouver group will actually be hosting another dinner just like this on September 23rd, so you might want to RSVP by going to meetup.com/vegvan. The Wallflower Restaurant is located at 2420 Main Street in Vancouver, and for more info, you can visit their website at thewallflowermoderndiner.com.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Allison. On the show, you know, I often talk about really unbelievable and most of the time disgusting details about animal exploitation industries. So today I want to share another one of those discoveries I made this week. Actually, I made a couple of them, but we only have time for one. My discovery this week kind of fits into the theme of our show today about laboratories. So Carissa and Allison, do you guys know what Petri dishes are?
Vaguely.
Well, there are those things, you know, plastic dishes that you grow culture on in laboratories. And, you know, on the bottom of them, usually you find like a nutrient base, right? So I found out this week from my dear friend, Twyla Francois, who is an investigator with CEDFA, Canadian for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, that the nutrient base used in Petri dishes is made of something called fetal bovine serum. Now, on the show, we talk a lot about the dairy industry and how the only way cows can produce milk is because we keep them constantly pregnant. And because they're mammals just like us, they don't produce milk unless they keep giving birth. So, you know, dairy cows are artificially inseminated, then hooked up to a milk machine. They give birth, and then they have their babies taken away. And then they continue to be milked after that process, and then they're re-impregnated again in a couple of months. So, you know, their bodies just become so taxed from all the milking, pregnancies, and then their bodies just become completely destroyed, so they go to slaughter. And at this point, you know, if you want to turn off the radio, if you're extra sensitive, please do so, because what I'm about to tell you is incredibly vile. So some of these cows, when they go to the slaughterhouse, they're pregnant. And when they reach the kill floor at the slaughterhouse, there are industries ready to exploit specifically pregnant cows and their unborn babies at the slaughterhouse. So when the pregnant cow is strung up by her hind leg to be slaughtered, she is forced to give birth when they take a knife and cut open her stomach. The baby usually is just days from being born, and they specifically plan to slaughter the animal at this stage of pregnancy. And when the baby falls out of his mother, who is split wide open, and he struggles to take his first breath on the slaughterhouse floor, someone comes, takes a needle, and jabs it into the baby's heart and sucks out all of the fluids from his heart as he makes his first call in life. This fluid they extract from his heart is what is known as fetal bovine serum, and it is the nutrient base used in all Petri dishes. And not surprisingly, the lab supply companies are usually situated nearby the slaughterhouses that kill pregnant cows. And so, you know, there's a connection between the labs and the dairy industry, and you can't really separate the exploitation. And then another thing I found out is that the leather industry is also connected, in that they covet the supple leather made from very young calves. And in the leather industry, they say the softer the leather, the younger the cow.
So if you shun meat for ethical reasons, it doesn't make any sense to continue drinking milk. And if you're against animal testing, you can't continue to wear leather. Nothing is really a byproduct. They're all somehow connected and interdependent on each other to make profits.
Thanks for sharing that, Joanna. That's something I really didn't know about before. We do have our next interview on the line, if you're ready for that.
My first guest is Rita Mashinsky. She is one of the many outstanding activists working on the Stop UBC Animal Research campaign, which made its debut last week on the cover of Vancouver Sun. Welcome to Animal Voices, and we're so sorry for all the technical difficulties.
Not a problem. I'm glad you guys are handling it and not me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about UBC Animal Research.
Well, Stop UBC Animal Research is a community grassroots campaign that promotes peaceful, legal, and compassionate approaches to educate the public about the grim realities of animals that are used in research in UBC labs. Our ultimate goal is really to bring an end to research on animals at UBC.
Mm-hmm. I think this is quite a new group, isn't it? When did it form?
We're spick and span brand new. We're actually started in February.
Wow.
This year.
That's great. And how many members have you managed to gather so far?
We have over 200 members, and more people are becoming, more people are becoming aware of the horror that the animals endure behind the closed doors, the membership is growing rapidly. It's amazing how many more members are joining us on a daily basis.
That's really good to hear. And can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your membership? What does it look like? Are they, you know, just ordinary folks, or what does your membership consist of?
We come from all walks of life. I'm proud to say we are a diverse group. Our members include architects, teachers, therapists, social workers, PhDs, engineers, business owners, high school students. We even have seniors. We even have UBC students and faculty members. We also have a few insiders at UBC who provide us with information. In fact, people can contact us at 604-551-3324, or we also have an email, and it's stopubcanimalresearch@gmail.com. I'm also proud to announce our recently launched website, stopubcanimalresearch.org. So if you feel passionate about this topic, please connect with us. Each voice counts, and as members increase, we will have more power to make positive changes to those who have no voice in our current society.
Mm-hmm. And I have seen the website. It looks really, really good. Now, why did you guys feel that there's a need to form this group?
Well, I believe that once you become aware of the gruesome reality of what the animals endure, it becomes hard not to join this campaign. So with this awareness, the question would be, how could we not form? UBC is one of the largest biomedical campuses in Canada. Every year, UBC conducts thousands of experiments on living beings. And this includes research on mice, rats, pigs, cats, non-human primates, rabbits, and many other animals. Some of that research is highly invasive and painful. And much of UBC research is paid for by taxpayer dollars. It's taxpayers, it's student fees, alumni gifts, and individual donations.
Mm-hmm.
Yet few area residents are actually aware of the UBC's extensive animal research program. So we thought that the public had the right to know that where their money is going, and the fact that it's being used to support subjecting animals in research. Also, UBC holds over 100,000 animals, and they may be expanding their facilities.
Wow, that sounds horrible. Now, can you go a little bit into the ethics of animal research? What is wrong with animal research?
Yes, that's a question I hear a lot. You know, it's like asking, why do fish need water? This type of question reflects on our society's current detachment or lack of awareness. Animal research is cruel. Even if the experiments are not highly invasive, these animals live in isolation. They live in cages among very sterile environments with no sunlight and never really being able to see sky, trees or be able to experience life surroundings outside their sterile environment. Many animals, especially highly social animals, such as non-human primates, suffer severe psychological trauma from lack of stimulation and no social interaction. The mental agony of isolation often causes the animals to go mad. Imagine being imprisoned all your life and being isolated with no stimulation. The only interaction these animals receive is to be taken out of their cages and face torture. Mm-hmm. Physical trauma can be severe. Some animals are exposed to toxic substances, undergo invasive surgeries, are restrained for long periods of time, injected with drugs, some are forced into addictions, some have electrodes or other devices permanently affixed to their heads or spine and given electroconvulsive shock. Most animals are killed at the end of an experiment. You know, the insanity of it all is that under such circumstances, those who are finally being put down are the lucky ones. Mm-hmm. The living continue to experience agony. Experiencing life in such a way makes death appear to be an exit from ongoing mental and physical torment that humans inflict on these beings. Mm-hmm. It simply must stop, and it's us, the everyday people, who need to make that change by putting pressure and using our voice. This is why Stop UBC Animal Research is such an important campaign.
Yes, it certainly is. And what is your ultimate goal?
Our objective is to educate the public about the grim realities of research on animals at the University of British Columbia and make the public aware of where their tax dollars are going. Our ultimate goal is to bring an end to research on animals at UBC. You know, in addition to the unethical and immoral approach of the current research practices, we also want the public to be aware that animal testing is scientifically flawed and that there are progressive and accurate research methods that do not require testing on animals. Safer Medicine Campaign is an independent patient safety organization of doctors and scientists who are revealing that animal testing is more harmful than helpful to public health and safety. They state that 92% of medicine that passes animal testing failed in human trials. In other words, this form of torture on animals is ineffective and has no valid scientific merit to it. This is primarily because of the differences in our genetic makeup, but more literature on this can be found on our website, stopubcanimalresearch.org. These are professionals that can explain it a lot better than I can.
I think that's really important information that not a whole lot of people know about, because most people think that, you know, medical research ultimately benefits humans. So what have you guys been up to since February?
We hold monthly meetings, which I encourage your listeners to attend. We welcome new members. And we have a lot of ways that people can get involved. For instance, we have a variety of committees. We have a research committee that investigates UBC's experiments. We have a fundraising committee that raises money for our many campaign needs. We have an outreach committee that distributes literature and updates on events around UBC's campus in Vancouver area. They also put up whistleblower posters. The whistleblower posters urges UBC researchers and students or others with inside knowledge of UBC's animal experiments to come forward with information. So if you have information, do call us. And again, the number is 604-551-3324. Or email us at stopubcanimalresearch@gmail.com. In addition, we've also created and launched our website and developed educational materials. We printed T-shirts, placed ads in the UBC student newspaper, and lots more. We also submitted Freedom of Information requests to UBC to gather information about UBC animal research. To celebrate our friendship and to take a break from what can be emotionally challenging work, we have social events like vegan potlucks and dine-outs. And we just had a major success. Last week, the Vancouver Sun ran a front-page story about our campaign. Mm. So we're pretty excited about that. We also are happy to announce our new website again. It's stopubcanimalresearch.org. In there, you can find more information about everything that I'm talking about.
And specifically about the animal research at UBC, how many animals are being experimented on?
Well, there are approximately 100,000 animals right now that are being experimented, and that data actually we found from UBC a newsletter actually, and we'd want to find out more information about it, but that's the whole struggle and the frustration is that they are very secretive about it, and you know, it's our taxpayer dollars that go promote, unfortunately, these researchers. So the least they can do is actually give us information of what exactly they are doing.
I guess UBC probably tells us that the research is saving lives. Can you tell us why you don't think so?
This is a common misconception that is being told to the general public. This is a myth that is being promoted by the conventional and outdated medical and corporate industries. Safer Medicine Campaign is an independent patient safety organization of doctors and scientists who are challenging this myth. They're disclosing that animal testing is more harmful than helpful to public health and safety. Their goal is to protect human health by promoting human-specific medical research. According to them, progress occurs despite animal testing, not because of it. Few people are aware of this factor. In fact, I did not know about that, so I'm glad to know that there are alternatives. According to the Safer Medicine Campaign, the current situation is unbearable, unsustainable, and most of all unjust. Not only do animals suffer and die in their millions, but the drugs and chemicals passed as safe on the back of animal testing turn out to cause some serious health problems in people. This is a quote from the medical journal. And this is what they say. Animal research does not reliably transfer to human patients. Many therapeutic and pharmacological disasters attesting to this fact. The reason for this is that there are immutable differences in autonomy, physiology, disease susceptibility, and the genetic makeup between humans and non-humans, end of quote. So in addition to the ethical principle of what is being done to these animals, there's also concern about how this method of research is posing a risk to human population. UBC would like us to believe that animal experiments have been responsible for medical advances in the past. According to Safer Medicine Campaign, real medical progress have relied on the following non-animal mythologies, and I'll be very brief about it because, again, all those details are on our website. Mm-hmm. There's in vitro test tube research that's been instrumental in many of the great discoveries of antibiotics. For example, the structure of DNA, as well as all the vaccines we have today, including poliomyelitis. Then there's the epidemiology, which is, I'm sure not pronouncing it correctly, but it's basically population research. And it's revealed that folic acid deficiency causes birth defects, that smoking causes lung cancer, and that lead damages children's brains. Then there's the genetic research, and it's shown that how certain genes are responsible for some diseases. DNA chips allow doctors to prescribe right drugs for specific patients, therefore reducing serious side effects for chemotherapy, for example. Then there's the human stem cells that have already treated children with leukemia and promised to deliver great benefits in the future. So Safe Medicine Campaign states that, and again, I'm quoting, clinical studies of patients have given us most of our current treatments and cures, including our treatments of lazy eye and knowledge that HIV transmission from mother to baby can be prevented. Human tissue is vital in the study of human disease and drug testing. Animal tissue differ in crucial ways. More information, again, is all that is on our website, but reality is there are accurate ways and scientifically based ways of conducting research that and what we're doing right now is absolutely barbaric.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Rita. Unfortunately, we're all out of time now, but we should have you guys on again another time, and we are going to announce your event. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Rita.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
I'll see you tonight.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, find out more about the campaign, visit stopubcanimalresearch.org and on to the events.
Yeah, so I am going to mention that fundraiser event that is happening tonight at 7 o'clock to 10:30 p.m. This is a fundraiser for the nonprofit group Stop UBC Animal Research, who we just heard from. This will happen at the Edge Pub at 303 Columbia Street in Vancouver. You are cordially invited to Stop UBC Animal Research's first fundraiser. Come enjoy good music and fine food in the modern gastropub setting. The ticket price is $5 and tickets are available at the door. Musical acts, sit back and enjoy the musical stylings of Dee Trevelyan and Reed Jameson, then dance into the night with resident DJ Avery. There's going to be food, drink, and door prizes. $2.50 for pints and $8.25 for pitchers. A vegan menu will be available, including delicious pizza with Day of Cheese, fabulous door prizes, and a 50-50 draw. Come have a fabulous time and support a great cause. All cover and ticket sales are going directly to Stop UBC Animal Research in association with the Haven Fund. Stop UBC Animal Research is an animal rights campaign that employs peaceful, legal, and compassionate approaches to educate the public about the grim realities of research on animals at the University of British Columbia and to ultimately bring an end to research on animals at UBC. So if you're not able to attend this event, you can also make a donation in lieu of your attendance. Just go to stopubcanimalresearch.com .org, I should say, and there will be a link on there to make a donation. So here we are. We've got Carissa and her news. Go ahead.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And here's the news. So police were executing a search warrant on a property near Christina Lake, and they found something just not quite right. As many as a dozen bears patrolling the property, which also housed a marijuana grow-op in excess of 1,000 plants. The police theorized that the bears were being fed dog food and vegetables to entice the bears to stay on as protection from other would-be criminals stealing the harvest. While the bears were found to be docile, chasing sticks and even walking on one of the police cruisers, Sergeant Fred Mansveld of the Integrated Road Safety Unit noted the worry over what will happen once their food source is gone, saying that they could become aggressive towards humans and they might eventually have to be destroyed. While there has been a focus lately on the feral bunny population at the University of Victoria and the efforts surrounding how to solve the problem, it is important to note that there is potential for the same problems right here in Vancouver and the surrounding areas. The local bunny population is booming due to overpopulation of local shelters, combined with little deterrent for those who release their unwanted bunnies into places such as Jericho Beach and parks in Ladner, Richmond, and Port Coquitlam. Carmina Gooch of the Rabbit Advocacy Group of British Columbia points out that most of the animals released have not been spayed or neutered, and said that municipalities have to be proactive and get some bylaws passed prohibiting the sale of unsterilized rabbits before the populations develop any further. The BCSPCA website notes that spaying or neutering your rabbit will not only prevent unwanted reproduction, but also decrease aggressive behaviors such as biting, growling, lunging, and circling, as well as prevent spraying to mark territories, ease litter box training, and prevent most cancers from developing, which is significant because nearly 80% of unspayed females will develop uterine cancer. Spaying and neutering your rabbit can go a long way to prevent the issues that might lead to releasing a rabbit from your care, as well as stop the potential for overpopulation among rabbits that do find their way outdoors. Spaying and neutering can be done at as young as 4.5 months of age and are very important considerations as the lifespan of a rabbit is between 7 and 12 years, so adopting a rabbit into your family is a commitment not to be taken lightly. And lastly, more than 30 spectators at a bullfighting event in Tafalla, Spain, were hurt Wednesday night when the bull successfully jumped a security barrier and charged through the crowded stands. The bull had already tried to jump the fence twice and broken one of his horns in the process before his successful attempt, after which he fell down several steps in the stands. It took multiple employees of the bull ring 15 minutes to rope the bull, named Quisero, who was then killed and removed by crane. Three people were still in hospital yesterday, including a 10-year-old boy. Injuries sustained included what was deemed to be abdominal trauma in the hospitalized boy as a result of Quisero falling on him, a crushed vertebrae in a 23-year-old woman, and wounds to the lower back suffered by a 47-year-old man who was gored in the accident. The remaining injuries were reported to be cuts, bruises, and shock. The event that led to this occurrence was not a traditional bullfight, but rather a contest of rectatores, in which participants try to dodge the bull while still remaining as close as possible to the animal they are taunting. Spain's bullfighting events end with the death of the bull used by way of sword, and a recent poll asserted that 60% of Spaniards do not approve of the spectacle.
You know, I saw that on the news, and I was rooting for the bull.
So was I.
And then Ben, who's right here, was saying, oh, but look what's going to happen to him. And then they killed him.
Well, they were going to kill him anyway by the sounds of it.
I know. Yeah. But at the same time, you're seeing the bull escaping. I'm like, make a run for it. But it never ends out well, does it?
It's not a sport, really, right? Because the animals always die.
It'll make people realize
that it's not a sport at all.
Yeah.
It's brutality. Exactly. So we've got our next interview on the phone, Joanne, if you want to go ahead.
Thank you, Carissa, for the news. Joining us on the line now is JB Mulcahy. I'm really excited to have him on. JB has been working with chimpanzees since 1998. He has worked for Fauna Foundation, the first sanctuary to rescue chimpanzees used in HIV research, and he holds a master's degree in primate behavior. JB is now the director of operations at Chimp Sanctuary Northwest. Welcome to Animal Voices, JB.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like you pursued an interest and career focused on primates from a very young age. What is it about primates that fascinates you so much?
Well, I mean, I guess it's the fact that when you look in a primate's eyes, especially the great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, orangutans, you really see a little bit of yourself in them. It's so easy to recognize their emotions. Their intelligence is obvious, and they were just, I think, the first animal that ever made me realize that there wasn't so clear of a line between humans and other animals.
Mm-hmm. Now, you currently work with 7 wonderful rescue chimps at the Chimp Sanctuary Northwest, known as the Klee Ilum 7, and their names are Annie, Burrito, Foxy, Jamie, Jody, Missy, and Negra. Can you tell us where the chimps came from and how they got to the sanctuary?
Well, the Klee Ilum 7 chimpanzees come from a variety of backgrounds. This is actually pretty common with laboratory chimpanzees. Some of them were captured in the wild back in the 1970s. Others were bred in captivity, but some were used for entertainment prior to going into research. So, for example, Jamie spent the first 9 years of her life in some sort of circus environment. We're not exactly sure what. Burrito was raised as a pet in the home of a laboratory owner and then leased to a circus for 2 years before being put into research. But they all ended up in hepatitis vaccine research, being owned by a company called the Buckshire Corporation. And Buckshire didn't do too much testing on site, but rather they would lease chimpanzees out to other research facilities. So the Klee Ilum 7 in their previous lives were shipped to New Mexico to a laboratory there. They were shipped to New York State to another laboratory. And finally, they ended up being warehoused at the Buckshire Corporation because no one wanted to pay to use them anymore. There was a surplus of chimpanzees for research. And so they sat there for about a decade.
Oh, my God.
Until Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest took them in.
So they sat there for a decade. How were they kept?
Well, at Buckshire, they lived in a windowless basement. It was a series of 4 interconnected cages. I would estimate that each one was about 8 feet by 8 feet, maybe 8 feet tall as well. And so they had no access to sunlight, to fresh air. They had nothing to stimulate them in that environment. There were a couple of hard plastic balls on top of the caging, but not even in the caging with them. The cages had concrete benches, which was their only form of enrichment, their only way to get up off the ground. Laboratory environments differ from facility to facility, but they're never good, and so it wasn't too surprising that that's how they lived.
So were they all isolated from one another?
They, thankfully, they lived together as a group for their last 2 years at the Buckshire Corporation, and sort of a long story as to why they were put together, but But nevertheless, they were allowed to live together. The cage doors between the cages were opened so that all seven had access to live in one social group.
Mm-hmm. So, you know,
prior to that, they would have spent many, many years in social isolation, especially when they were on a research protocol.
Yeah, I noticed that Foxy just celebrated her 34th birthday, and most of the chimps, I think all of them are in their 30s now. Have they been in a lab situation for most of their lives?
Except for Jamie and Burrito, who we know either lived in a human home or traveled with a trainer for entertainment, the rest were in research for their entire lives.
How long do chimpanzees generally live for?
Wild chimpanzees might live to about 40. Chimpanzees in captivity, for example, zoos, tend to live a bit longer. But research chimps tend to live about as long as their wild counterparts, not necessarily because of the effects of the viruses that they're injected with, but from the trauma of the testing itself. So, for example, these guys in vaccine research, they're given an experimental vaccine, and then to test for toxicity of the vaccine, they're given repeated liver biopsies. Some of those are punched biopsies where they take a very large needle, go right into the liver, take a sample out. Others are open wedge biopsies where they do an open surgery and take and slice out a piece of the liver. And having dozens of biopsies over the years, it's a lot of trauma to the liver. It's there's a lot of potential for low-grade chronic infection. And so many chimps who were used in vaccine research do succumb to liver failure when they get older.
Wow. You know, I'm always so amazed at the resilience of these animals rescued after long-term abuse. And it's like no matter how hard we try to break them down, they seem to pick up the pieces and find themselves. And it's been 2 years since these chimps moved to the sanctuary. What sort of transformations have you seen in them?
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right about the resilience. I always say to people that the resilience of chimpanzees is one of the things I admire most about them, and yet it's also their downfall. It's what allows them to be used for decades on end with, you know, with no stimulation, with all this trauma. But like you said, when they're retired, when they're released to a sanctuary, they can have a life again. And specifically with the Cleom 7, we saw some really amazing transformations. We actually, prior to their arrival at the sanctuary, we went to the Buckshire Corporation to visit them so that we could start to get to know them a little bit and they could get to know us before being transferred to the sanctuary. And the chimps that we met that first day at the Buckshire Corporation are not the chimps that we know now. And even the first few weeks of being at the sanctuary, they were not really chimps at all. Chimps are incredibly boisterous. They're loud. They've got so much energy. And these guys, when they were first at the sanctuary, they were quiet. They really just weren't acting like chimps. They were nervous. And for all they knew, we could have been another lab, just a bigger one with nicer people. But then they started to sort of take ownership of the sanctuary. And that's when we saw their personalities really start to develop. And maybe for the first time ever, maybe they never had a chance to have these personalities before. One great example is Foxy, you mentioned earlier.
Foxy, she's my favorite.
She came to the sanctuary. Yeah, she's, not that I have favorites, but she's very special. At the sanctuary, we provide a lot of environmental enrichment. So basically, that just means toys, blankets, things to play with. Right away when the chimps got here, we gave them all sorts of toys that they'd probably never seen before. And some of the chimps took to them immediately. And Foxy was different, though. Foxy was so used to having nothing that she didn't want anything around her. Mm-hmm. And the other chimps would take blankets or straw and make nests at night. And Foxy would push all those things out of the way so that she could lie on the bare concrete floor and go to bed. And then one day, Diana, who is our director of outreach, was at, I believe it was Goodwill, and found a little troll doll. And probably everybody remembers the troll dolls, the little ugly dolls with the colorful long hair. And so Foxy picked up this troll doll. She wouldn't touch anything else, but this was something that interested her. And then we noticed the next day she still had it, and the day after that she still had it. We couldn't get this thing back from her to clean it. So we have a blog where we share the lives of the chimps with folks, and we had that from day one. And so we had some followers already at that point. We told everybody, hey, Foxy really likes these troll dolls. Does anyone have one they can send? And, you know, within a couple of months, we had like 200 trolls. and she loved all of them. And she particularly likes them when they have hair. But Jamie, one of the other chimps, maliciously likes to rip the hair off of her.
Oh.
But then we sort of refer to trolls as Foxy's gateway enrichment, because her, taking a liking to this troll sort of opened her up to using other forms of enrichment, and now she'll use some of the other toys. And we even caught her on the 1 year anniversary of the chimp's arrival. We caught her going to bed and using a red blanket to make a little bit of a nest.
That's very sweet. Now, besides Burrito, the rest of the seven chimps are all females, and Foxy is a female as well. And they've each been used to breed the next generation of captive research chimps. Do you know what kind of emotional toll this has taken on the chimps?
Yeah, you know, it's always, obviously it's impossible to say exactly how the chimps feel, but their emotions are very, very similar to ours. The bonds between mothers and their children is just like the bond between any other mother and any other child, including humans. Mm-hmm. So when these chimps are bred in laboratories, their babies are taken away either on the day they're born or shortly thereafter. Some facilities allow some chimps to remain with their mothers for a couple of months, but never any longer than that. So it's an incredible psychological toll. And, you know, some of these folks, all of the females except Jamie, gave birth in the lab. And Jody had at least 9 babies taken from her in her time in the laboratory. So, it's obviously very traumatic.
Yeah. Have you ever tracked down any of their children?
We have. We've done some investigating with that, and then we also have one of our supporters who done a great job looking through records and talking to other sanctuaries to see where all of these folks are. And some of the chimps' children are somewhat lucky, and they made it out of research and into other sanctuaries. Mm. So, for example, Negra has 2 children, Noah and Angel, that are at Save the Chimps, a really wonderful sanctuary in Florida. Unfortunately, some of the other offspring are still in laboratories. And right now we're working to halt the transfer of 202 chimpanzees from a facility in New Mexico where they're being warehoused and not being used for research. And they are going to be shipped to a facility in Texas that will put them back into research. And 3 of our chimps' offspring are in that group that are unfortunately going to go back into invasive research.
And what can our listeners do to help stop these chimps from going back to research?
They can write to the National Institutes of Health. There is a group in New Mexico called APNN, Animal Protection in New Mexico, that's working really hard to stop this transfer. They've gotten a lot of support. In fact, Governor Bill Richardson is working to stop the transfer as well in New Mexico. And anyone that wants to help can also just contact us directly through our website, and we can point them in the right direction.
That would be great. While looking through your Facebook group yesterday, I saw that Dodge Caravan recently aired a commercial with a chimp in it. Can you tell us what happened after the executive director of your organization sent in an email regarding the chimps in entertainment?
Yeah, this is actually one of those great success stories where things work out better than you even imagine they would. But yeah, Dodge used a young chimpanzee actor in an ad for a sale that they were having, and it basically involved this young chimp walking up to light off an explosive, and it ends up just being a little burst of confetti. And so our executive director, Sarah Beckler, she wrote a letter to the CEO of Dodge. And Sarah actually, prior to the start of this sanctuary, she worked undercover at a chimpanzee training facility outside of Hollywood. And she witnessed the systematic abuse of very young chimpanzees for entertainment, and exposed what was going on there, and actually got those chimps transferred to a sanctuary. And that trainer agreed to never work with chimps again. So she wrote a very polite letter to the CEO saying what she knew about the abuse that goes on in the entertainment industry, and asked Dodge to pull the ad and reconsider their use of chimpanzees in their commercials. And very shortly after, got a reply from the CEO saying, you know, he had no idea that this is what was going on. They promised to pull the ad and said that they would never use chimps again in advertising.
Wow.
And what they actually did was it's kind of funny. They basically went out and edited out the chimpanzee, but left the clothing. So it's this invisible chimp going up and down to light up this explosive.
That's quite odd.
And, yeah, it was interesting.
Very odd.
But then what they do is just, now they have this theme, and it says, "Where's the monkey?" Obviously, chimpanzees are not monkeys, but they're just trying to be cute with this thing. And that directs people to a webpage that explains why they took the chimp out of the commercial.
Wow. No, that's
why
amazing.
They won't use primates anymore. So it's a really amazing thing. It shows how much of an impact we can have if we write letters, and especially instead of venting and taking it on people, writing a very polite, understanding letter and assuming that people don't always know what's going on, and sort of meeting them where they are and trying to educate them.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing enough that the CEO replied, let alone take some action on it. So that was really great. And back to the chimps again. Now, I know the seven of them lived together, and you said they lived together prior to coming to the sanctuary. Do you think there would be problems integrating them if they had not known each other? Say, like, if you had just rescued them from isolation, would they have gotten along if you just put them together?
It's certainly a challenge to integrate chimpanzees, and actually none of us here have a whole lot of experience with it. So if we were to introduce a new chimp, we would probably hire a consultant to give us a hand. It's not rocket science, but you really do have to understand, first of all, the chimps that you're working with, which we do know well now at this point, but you also just have to sort of know from a gut feeling, having experience doing this, how to go about it. And it basically involves understanding chimpanzee social dynamics, their hierarchy, looking for affiliations between pairs where they might back each other up and form a team, and then sort of arranging those pairs so that they meet in a certain order. It can be very, very complicated. Mm. And it can be very dangerous, and chimpanzees have suffered serious injuries and have even died during
wow.
social introductions.
They just seem to get along so well. I thought they just kind of, you can just throw them in there and they'll just be happy friends.
Yeah, well, you know, the one thing that's interesting about that is there is a certain bias in what we put on the blog. For example, if the chimps are having a very serious fight, the last thing we're going to do is go grab a camera and film it all,
right.
Because we're sort of waiting there watching to see if anyone's going to need medical attention
right.
or anything like that. I would love to show people what a chimp fight looks like. And there actually was, we had a Seattle TV station out filming once, and the chimps had a fight while they were filming. So that's like the one time that we've really recorded it. But it's incredibly intense, and they do injure each other fairly seriously once in a while. And thankfully, chimps heal incredibly well, and we haven't had to intervene with any sort of surgery or anything like that. But we have given out a lot of antibiotics and pain relievers and things like that for those that come out on the losing end of these fights.
Now, we only have about a minute left, and I just want you to tell us about this huge, exciting plan you have coming up for the chimps, which involves 2 acres of land. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, currently the chimps have a 1,200 square foot indoor playroom, and then they have a 600 square foot outdoor area, but they need much more than that. And above the chimp house is a huge pasture. And so what we're planning to do is to, using electric fence, to fence in 2 acres of that pasture. We're going to plant bamboo out there, build 2- and 3-story climbing structures for the chimps. And for the first time, for some of them, for the first time in their lives, they'll be outdoors in the sun with no bars overhead, sitting in the grass, about as natural as they're going to get.
And how can people help out with that fundraiser?
Well, there are a couple ways, but we're encouraging people to attend our gala auction in Seattle on October 1st. We'll be doing a fund an item during the auction where people can donate towards that project, but people can also just send in a general donation to help out with the expense of this project. And also, if anyone is in the general area, we're looking for help with construction as well.
Thank you so much for joining us today, JB.
Thank you. That was so interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. To learn more about the chimp at Chimps at Chimp Sanctuary Northwest, please visit chimpsanctuaryNW.org. And if you want something to make you smile, be sure to watch the videos on their blog.
I'm going to want to smile tonight when I'm at work in my graveyard. So that's what I'm going to look at. You have been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Remember to sign up for our Facebook, on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And also please check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded from. Next week on the show, please join us again as we'll be interviewing Dr. Donald Forrester of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine to talk to us about the health benefits of a vegan diet, as well as the PCRM's upcoming 21-day vegan kickstart program, which starts on September the 6th. Please tune in again next week, and thank you for listening.
Have a good weekend. Thank you.